Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and that was not our usual intro music by John Rauhaus, as I'm sure many of you have noticed, but it was an incredible interpretation of Blackbird by today's podcast guest, Mark Leggett. If your social media feed is anything like mine, at any given point, there are probably a ton of videos of guys playing guitars on it. Most of the times, I skip right over them. I feel like I've seen them before or aren't really interested in the music or the playing. But when I saw Mark's video of him playing that very tune, Blackbird, I sort of stopped in my tracks. For starters, I knew absolutely nothing about this guy, and he was getting the most incredible Cooter-esque tones out of his guitar. And he just seemed like an interesting dude who I knew absolutely nothing about. So I reached out to him, not knowing anything about him, and that is today's conversation. You will find out about Mark just as I will. I hope you like it. Who is Mark Leggett? He, it turns out, is a studio musician down in Los Angeles who's had an incredibly interesting career writing music for movies and TV shows, including My Name is Earl. He is now working on some solo material that I can't wait to hear. If you want to follow him and find out what he is up to and see his videos as he posts them, they are incredible. Just go over to Facebook and he's Mark Leggett, that's LeggettMusic, and you can follow him alongside me. Today's podcast is sponsored by Dying Breed Music. Lane over at Dying Breed is all about premium vintage flat top guitars from, of course, Martin, Gibson, and other brands. You can find his whole inventory over at dyingbreedguitars.com, or you can just call him up at 877-818-3434. This guy loves to chat about vintage guitars and what he has in stock and his consignment program and whatever else is on your mind. He really cares about his customers. I've discovered that over the years as I've worked with him, and I think you will too. Right now, among other things, he has a very cute little 1944 Martin 0017 for sale, a Banner 1944 Gibson Southern Jumbo, and perhaps coolest of all, a 1939 Recording King Ray Whitley that has rosewood back and sides. That is an ultra-rare Gibson-built guitar that is just about as cool as any vintage flat top you will ever find. Check that out, and if you ever have any questions, hit Lane up. Once again, it's dyingbreedguitars.com. Don't forget to tell him the Fretboard Journal sent you. Before I get to my talk with Mark, the new Fretboard Journal 41 is, of course, out now. It's mailing to everybody. It's probably showing up at Barnes & Noble's and guitar stores right about now, too. Get it while you can. We've been selling out of issues lately. Jason Isbell is on the cover of this issue. I think he likes our interview, as he just shared it on his Twitter feed, the cover of the magazine. We've also got stories on Dick Boak, David Rawlings, and an incredible Michael Chapdelaine feature that really should be turned into a screenplay, although no one would believe it. Michael's had such a interesting and dramatic career over the years, and I think we did it justice. So check that out if you are at all into Michael's music or just a good guitar tale. So you can subscribe to our magazine at fretboardjournal.com, and if you use the coupon code PODCAST, I will take $5 off of your order. We are hard at work here in Seattle on our 42nd issue, putting the finishing touches on it. And it does look like I am going to follow through with my threat to do an all-electric fifth issue for 2018. That would come out midsummer. So there's that. We're plenty busy here. And in case you missed it, just to make our lives a little more chaotic, we are throwing a big party for the Fretboard Journal 41's release, but also just to meet up with some of you guys in Austin, Texas in just a couple of weeks. That's March 27th from 6 to 10 p.m. We're calling it Fretboard Journal Live. We've partnered with our friends at Callings Guitars and Calton Cases. The party's actually going to be at the new Calton Cases factory in East Austin. And we're basically going to be bringing the magazine to life for a few hours. We are going to be doing some on-the-spot interviews. We're going to be probably recording a live podcast there. Red Volkert's going to be there. Anthony DaCosta's going to be there. Paul Glass, the amazing electric mandolin player, and a bunch more. We've got some surprise guests that we haven't even announced yet. There will be free food and free beer, and all we ask is a small donation at the door, which is going to go to charity. There'll be readings from the magazine as well from guys like Nathaniel Riverhorse Nakadate and perhaps myself, if my voice ever comes back, and a bunch more. If you want to get an invite to it, if you are anywhere near Austin, Texas, please come. You can just hit me up at jason@fretboardjournal.com, and we will get you in. Right now, the guest list is growing exponentially, and that is a very cool thing. It'll be great to meet some of you guys. Next week's guest on the podcast is going to be Glenn Jones, the incredible fingerstyle guitarist who was also in the band Cul-de-Sac, which had a huge impact on me in the 90s, got me into the whole guitar nerd world. I hope you like it. We had a great chat. Glenn is kind of helping curate this incredible festival. It's taking place in Tacoma Park, Maryland next month, called the Thousand Incarnations of the Rose. And it is basically a weekend-long music festival dedicated to the music of John Fahey and what is now called the American Primitive Guitar Movement. So you'll hear all about that next week, though. I don't need to talk to you about it right now. If you like what we are up to on the Fretboard Journal podcast, please, please, please subscribe to it via iTunes or Stitcher or whatever podcast app you use. And please leave us, or think about leaving us, a review, either a written review or a star review over on iTunes. It actually helps us out with our search rankings and lets other guitar fanatics find out about the Fretboard Journal podcast easier. All right, enough of my windbag intro. Here is my talk with Mark Leggett. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much, everyone. So Mark, I think, like a lot of folks, I found you through the magic of social media and your incredible Cooter-esque interpretation of Blackbird. And, you know, as a guitarist, you hear a lot of interpretations of Blackbird and think you've kind of heard it all. But yeah. I fell in love with yours. It was tasteful. It was awesome. The playing was incredible. The tone you get out of that weird Tysco-looking thing is great.
Yeah, it's just a little Tysco. It's got a new neck, but the electronics are pretty much, you know, intact the way it was in the 60s.
So before we get to all that recent stuff, where, you know, what's your story? When did you take up guitar? Obviously, you're a pro down in L.A., but let's hear a little bit about your background.
Oh, just, you know, like a lot of people my age, I'm 63, and, you know, when I was 12, you know, it was Beatles, and everything, all the you know, popular music at that time, but a lot of Beatles stuff, and just started playing tunes in bands like everybody. We were Air Force kids and lived all over the country, which was kind of an asset. I didn't know that at the time, but, you know, every time we'd move and get stationed in another part of the country, I would fall in with a bunch of musicians who were always better than me, so that was a very fortunate thing, and always picking up stuff on guitar, and you know, came out to L.A. in 79 and struggled for a good 15 years just playing dives and trying to write mainly. You know, I had a publishing deal and then doing that stuff and played guitar on people's tracks. And I played on way back in 88, there was a dance, in the middle of the dance Madonna craze, there was an artist named Martika out here in L.A.
Sure.
Who had a song called Toy Soldiers. And I played on that, played the solo, played all the parts on that, and it went to number one. So that was kind of a cool thing at the time. And so, you know, I did a bit of session work, nothing heavy, and always wrote and got into writing and got into television and small films and spent the last, I don't know, 15 years now just mostly doing that, doing a lot of writing, but always playing. And in the last, always on the side, just working on fingerstyle stuff, working on slide. I always played slide as a kid. And then, you know, I started seeing, when Sonny Landreth became popular back several years ago, it was like, oh, you can do that. You know, you can back fret. And I didn't know that. So I started working on little things like that. I don't do it nearly to that extent or that well, but I can work out arrangements and you know, get those back notes in. And messing with different tunings. And obviously Cooter was always a big influence. And a lot of young guys now, you know, Blake Mills and those guys are just an inspiration to anyone of any age.
Yeah.
You know, so that form, I think, has come a long way. There are so many good guitar players now, and social media has definitely brought that to the front. It's just every day you find somebody's like, oh my God, where'd this guy come from?
Yeah.
The whole thing's been fun. You know, I'm getting back more into guitar and less doing writing for media and television and stuff. And just playing a lot of guitar, playing solo gigs. I've got a quartet, instrumental quartet, that I play around L.A. with. And just doing mostly tunes of mine, but the solo stuff I do, these arrangements I have up, the Blackbird and the She's Leaving Home that I just put up last week, is doing pretty well. And that's, you know, that and a bunch of Kotke stuff I do solo and several of my things. And I'm just kind of reverting to my youth now, being a guitar player again. So I
got to ask about the studio and, you know, television work that you've done, because obviously it's paid the bills. You've been doing it for a while. And I know for some, it can really pay the bills quite handsomely if you get in connected with the right people. Are you actually using a lot of guitar there, or have you been forced to use keyboards and whatever the task at hand is?
You know what? It's a mix, and I think the reason I was working for the last 15 years is because I was able to add guitar textures, whereas, you know, that kind of writing, you know, it's all kind of sample-based, and, you know, it can be orchestral writing, it can be small ensemble writing, it can be anything these days. You got to be prepared to write anything. But I've always tried to work the guitar into it, and when I did this show, My Name is Earl, that was a blast because that was guitars, guitars, guitars all day long, and it was fun, you know. And it was a pretty quick turnaround on that show. Being a sitcom, it was still loaded with music, and it was fun. Did it with my friend Danny Lux, the other composer on it, who's a great drummer and composer, and we had a ball doing that for 4 years. But typically, in a lot of the things I've done, I get called because there is guitar in there, you know, and it's a part of the score. And that's happening more and more now, too. Instead of doing the orchestral mock-up or hiring an orchestra or doing that type of music, the smaller ensemble stuff, textural stuff, is quite popular, you know, which is great for guitar. I'm a big David Torn fan, so, you know, if you can bring in textures like that, electric textures and things, it definitely sets you apart from some of the things that are out there.
And in the case of, just because you brought it up, My Name is Earl, like, are you in your own studio getting clips from the actual sitcom that you are then composing to, or how does it work?
Yeah. Once you get the job, once they hire you, you're at the end of the post-production chain. Everything's shot, everything's edited, and they send you that week's episode, and you have 4 or 5 days to do the music, hopefully. And if there's a lot, that can be a grind. And you just, you have spotted the show with the producers or director, whoever it is. And they say, oh, we want something like this here, and do something like this here, and do lay out here, and do that. You know, they called spotting. And then, I've got a great studio, and everything's up on the screen. And you just start, you know, carving out the music, you know, playing. If it's a guitar-based thing, I always usually start with a guitar. If it's a rhythmic thing, you'd start with drums. We've got everything set up here for small ensemble stuff, mic'd and ready to go. So, they send you hopefully the final episode. There may be some tweaks later that you may have to accommodate, but you write it to the picture, and it was a blast doing that show. And other things are a little more keyboard oriented and can be.
Yeah. But bringing your friends in or associates when you need the drummers or whatever?
Exactly. Yeah, on that case, and Earl, Danny was the drummer, Danny Lux, and the co-composer on stuff. And there was a big harmonica spot in all those shows, and we used the great Stan Behrens, a guy down here who plays with War and has played with Willie Dixon back in the old days, fabulous harp player, and he would come in and play harmonica. And that was pretty much the only outside stuff, because it was just, you know, mostly guitars and drums. And I would add bass to that. But when we do other things that are not guitar-oriented, you know, we can get, you know, a small string ensemble, up to 12 strings in here, you know, full rhythm section, you know, in separate times, and woodwinds, anything we need. You know, it depends on the job, and once you figure out what the job needs, the show or the film, you know, you accommodate with those musicians. You just get guys that you know, you go through. There are tons of people down here that are great to work with. and you hire the players.
Yeah, and this is a studio that you've kind of built specifically for your needs?
I did.
That's wild.
Because I was always renting other houses, and I had places around my neighborhood where I would rent a place for a while and, you know, be locked in there because there wasn't room at home. Finally, about, I guess, 10, 11 years ago, built this place, and it's just attached to my house. It's good size and good live room, which I've never had. So it's a luxury for sure.
I bet.
I can crank up amps in the middle of the night. Nobody cares.
And I'm assuming it looks just like a regular studio, except maybe you have a big screen for viewing these shows.
Yeah, there are screens around. I can send you some shots of it, too.
Sure.
There was a little tour actually I'd done with some guys that was on Facebook. I don't know if it's still on there, but they had done it for some promotion reasons. And, it looks sort of barn-like, but it's a real studio. It's all wired. It's all acoustically done. It's a great place to work.
Yeah. So the My Name is Earl gig sounds like it was kind of the dream gig, especially for somebody with your music taste. Are these gigs lucrative enough that, you know, as long as they don't get canceled, you can kind of make a year's living off these things?
You can. And it, you know, it used to be about the royalties in the back end, as it was before streaming. You know, people could get paid for their songs on the radio, and people could get paid for music on television.
Sure.
That's slowly diminishing, just like it is with everything. You know, any of the back end seems to be changing radically, and has for several years. But yeah, you could definitely. It can be lucrative if it's a hit show, and there's lots of music, and if the fees are good. Now they're paying less for music. And they're paying less royalties for music. Every time it airs, you know, you used to be able to get a decent royalty for it. That is kind of diminishing now.
Yeah.
So, not as lucrative as it used to be, I'll say.
Is there a lot of competition for your role, or are there just a handful of guys? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because, you know what you can do with a computer now, a laptop. You can cut together a bunch of loops and edit and record in your instruments. And so a lot of people tend to, you know, get their music out there to producers and hustle music. And, you know, there are more people and less gigs. So
yeah,
it's easy to have a product these days with the technology, which I think is great. It's liberating for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's a creative thing. And, you know, hopefully the cream rises on some of that stuff. And I think it does.
Yeah. Not to get too nerdy, but, you know, what kind of fidelity...
Please, no, I want to get nerdy.
what kind of fidelity do these TV shows require of you? They get viewed by millions of people. I imagine they don't need to be that, you know, mastered that well, but maybe they do.
Not like a CD, but they are... There are pro mixers out there that mix for television, that mix for film, particularly film, you know, all over the world, that what you do is you write your piece and you send them your separated tracks. You write your, they call them stems in the post-production world, your stems of music, your individual tracks. Say one track's all drums, one track's all guitars, one track's violins. And, you know, if there's a grind and it's a weekly grind, you pretty much get the mix down at your place and you send it off. The fidelity is really good. But the for a big film or even a small film, I would hire a really good mixer to take it into a different studio and really mix the music against the dialogue that's happening on the screen. So you're sure not to step on key dialogue moments, certain effects. They weave it into the picture and they do master it to a degree. So it's a whole different process than mastering for a CD or for an artist endeavor, you know, artist mix. It's more about, you know, dialogue and picture is king, and you're there to support it and not get in the way. So a good mixer does that for you in post-production, in music for media.
Yeah, and all this gets turned around in 4 days.
It can. Yeah, if that's the grind. Yeah, there are a lot of shows out here that, you know, they just expect everything very quickly. And it's even compounded when you do have to work with an orchestra, because you have that other layer of coordination that has to happen, and it can be very people stay up for hours and hours.
Yeah,
so it's a grind. But I'm not so much in that world as much now. I'm just trying to do these guitar pieces and get out and play more, and still, you know, write the occasional small film and TV show that comes in, and documentary, but not as much as I did. It was a real grind for many years.
And what, was there kind of a turning point? Did you burn out and decide, like, hey, I'm going to actually start playing out again, or did it just kind of...
Yeah. And it was the job, you know, as I said, it's oversaturated with people that are vying for those positions. And, you know, a lot of great young guys coming up, and, you know, they get their shot, and I think that's healthy, that's good. You know, I had plenty of work for years. But I'm just, you know, getting back into playing guitar again, being a guitar player, which is fun, and practicing more than I ever did. So, and I have the carpal tunnel to prove it. So,
oh, no.
You know, but it's good. I mean, I will play 4 or 5 hours a day and, you know, have to wear a little brace at night, but, you know, just to keep the carpal tunnel from the fingers from swelling too much, but it, you know, it works out.
Now, in every video I've seen, it's never of you, all these recent ones, you're kind of always playing, it seems like, slightly offbeat guitars, maybe guitars that, you know, aren't as collectible. I saw you play a Fender acoustic that looked like it was relatively recent. When you were doing these big name TV shows and movies, were they all funky guitars behind the scenes as well?
You know what? It depended on a lot of times for the recording, I'll use a really nice Martin, or I have a good Kevin Ryan acoustic. But there were times on the My Name is Earl show is I went and bought a $14 pink guitar at a swap meet out here, and it was a real piece of crap, and we just detuned it almost in unison and played it I would play it, some real trashy stuff on it, and it was the perfect vibe for that, for certain pieces of music in the show. And put that against some trash can kind of loop, you know, and it was a real gritty sound. But usually if it's a really nice guitar, I will use a good guitar. Some of the cheaper guitars, the electrics, you know, they work for certain things. TV shows, yeah, you want the audio, unless it's an effect, you want the audio to be really good going in. So you record at a high sample rate and you'll try to get a good instrument and good miking. But for the guitar stuff, using the Tyscos and the fingerstyle stuff and slide that I do when I do my videos, you know, those guitars sound fine.
Yeah.
And I had the neck replaced on a few of them. You know, I had them worked on so they would intonate properly.
Do you have a guy you go to for all your repair needs?
Yeah, John Carruthers has been out in L.A. for many, many years and was kind of luthier to the stars years ago.
Sure.
And he's out. He's actually moved out close to me. And I'll go over there, and he does a lot of work over there. Makes great guitars. I've got several of his electrics, electric acoustic guitars. And I have a Tele he made for me in his shop that's really nice. But, yeah, he's very close and very good.
Yeah. And what amp are you using for, like, the Blackbird clip that at least all my friends saw on Facebook?
The Blackbird one was... I don't think there's an amp in there. I think it's straight DI.
Okay.
It goes straight and direct. No, there was. I take that back. There was a feed to an amp, and it was just a little Fender Princeton, one of the newer ones, you know, that's been outfitted with new transformers, but new transformer and new speaker and everything. But just something to give it a little bit of an amp feel, but mostly it was the direct input, you know, and compress it in Pro Tools and add a little bit of reverb and delay. And then, you know, after it's recorded and the video's done, I really go in and work on the guitar sound, make sure it's, you know, mixed well for the video.
Yeah.
It makes it stand out a little bit.
Yeah. Was it a weird Fender acoustic on the Kaki?
On that. Oh, it was, I can't find my way home.
Yeah.
A little. That was more of an experiment, and I don't know. I see it now. It doesn't seem so good to me, but it was a high strung. I took this cheap. It was a $100 Fender acoustic that recent, you know, student guitar, but I carved out the sound hole and was able to stick a pickup in there, a magnetic pickup, and then I high strung it. So the sixth and fifth and fourth strings are an octave higher than a normal guitar. So you play the same voicings, the same fingerings, but all your low strings are actually an octave higher. So that's what gave it that little weird sound. That was just kind of a gimmick, I think. But people seem to like that one, too. I actually am in the middle of recording a CD now, and that's going to go on there on a proper, beautiful Martin, you know, with a really good open acoustic sound.
So, okay.
So working on that stuff. I'm going to add some of the trio stuff, quartet stuff of mine, instrumental stuff to this CD, and just represent some of the stuff that I've been working on the last couple of years.
I was going to ask, because you know, a lot of your videos kind of hint at a solo record or a record
yeah.
coming soon. It's not all Beatles covers. It's kind of an eclectic
no,
mix.
It's a little bit of everything. A couple of Leo Kottke things that I've learned and messed with. I hope he doesn't hear him because it's probably blasphemy. But he's just an idol, you know, of mine. And then a few of the Beatle things and several of my things. And it's just kind of, it takes a while to put a CD out for me just to commit because, you know, I'll say, oh, I could have played that better and come in the next day. Well, having your own studio is the kiss of death sometimes because you will go in the next day and try to beat it and do it. And that just drags the whole process out. So I'm in the process of trying to just get my chops up in the morning, get warmed up properly and get in and record a piece and not beat it to death and keep thinking, oh, I can do that better tomorrow.
You got to give yourself the 4-day deadline.
Just that's pretend. True. Yeah. I do. I'm going to have to do that here soon too. But, yeah, I just like getting back into the guitar.
This yeah.
is a lot of fun.
And what kind of gigs around Southern California are you playing?
I've been playing at a place every month or two, a place called Trip over on Lincoln near Santa Monica. And it's a kind of a showcase room, bar, good sound system, not too big. A lot of people play there with a quartet, which is a lot of fun. It's guitar, bass, drums, and percussion. So there's no keyboard. Plenty of room for me to hot dog around. and then I do solo acoustic jobs with some electric guitar, but mostly acoustic. I played at a place called Vitello's, open for a CD release party recently, which was a really good turnout. And I'm going to play down in a place called down south of L.A. Called Alvis Showroom, opening for a jazz trombonist, actually, with this incredible band, and the promoter asked me to open the show. So I'm going to do that. There's a great place in Santa Monica called Unurban Cafe that has a lot of great music. It's a coffee shop, but it's just a beautiful little room, and I'm going to get in there and play my solo gig and my quartet to do the second set. So that'll be in March. And just keeping busy. You know, the gigs come in a couple times a month. I'll go out and play, which is fine.
And still occasionally record stuff at home, I guess.
Yeah, all the time. That's happening. That happens all day long. Yeah, always recording. And working on arrangements at night and then come in and try to record them in the daytime.
So being in Southern California and being in the business, have you been able to meet some of your guitar heroes like Cooter?
No, I never have.
No?
not really. I would see, years ago I used to go to the NAMM show. I haven't been in, 10 years. But, you know, I would run into people there and say hi. But you know, no. I think, you know, I said hi to Bill Frisell in a club once.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a good guy. He's approachable.
Oh, yeah. What a man. What a person. I just think he's great. Incredible musician, obviously. But, yeah, no real connection to some of the people like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's just so many good people to go here, you know, in clubs out here when they do play.
Totally. And for folks who maybe want to or are spending time watching the big screen or the TV, what anything recent that we should keep our ears out for hearing you?
Nothing. You know, in the last couple of years, I did the music score for these Dolly Parton TV movies that were out in the last couple of years that were out over the holidays. They were called Code of Many Colors.
Okay.
Those were on NBC and they run every Christmas now. We did one last year. There's another Dolly Parton one I'm doing coming up called, based on the song Jolene, which they're supposed to start filming this spring. And that'll be happening, hopefully. We'll probably be doing the music probably towards the end of the year. startup on the score. That's the one big job. And little things come in all the time. I'm going to do a documentary on William Faulkner, on his life story. That's going to come in,
nice,
I think, this summer. So just, you know, nice little projects like that.
Do you ever meet, like, Dolly Parton or the people on the TV shows that you're making music for?
Yeah. Yeah, Dolly was here at my studio and a year ago or so. And on the My Name is Earl cast, Jason Lee and those guys, we would see them. You know, they'd come in and do, if there were any on camera of them singing or anything musical on camera, we would work with them. And, yeah, who else was here? Somebody else. I forget.
Did Dolly Parton geek out on your guitars or anything, or no?
No, I mean, she's very sweet. She, you know, she looked at, I have this little old 1930s mini banjo uke that are around, and she was kind of enamored with that. Where did you get that? You know, I want that for my grandkids.
Got it.
Or for her nieces, I believe. But she was very sweet. She's very cool.
Nice.
What a talented person to be around.
Yeah. For sure.
Kind of intimidating.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you for talking to us, and I hope you'll keep me posted on when the solo album comes out, and I hope you keep posting stuff on Facebook and YouTube, because it's incredible.
I will, and I'll keep you in the loop, and, you know, send you emails and updates of what's coming up.
Awesome.
I appreciate you. Thank you for the interview. I appreciate this.
Of course, yeah. It's great to get the backstory on these mysterious videos that sort of just feed your wall, or, you know, just you start seeing them all over the place.
I know. It really surprised me that they got that popular, and they continue to do so. So I'm gonna start, you know, trying to do one a month if I can, or maybe even more.
All right.
And keep coming up with arrangements.
All right, man. Sounds great.
Cool.